You've got to understand something. I'm on this cold brew high putting together this week's episode because sometimes things don't come together until the last minute and you're hustling and you're so tired that you feel drunk. But here we are. Man. So how are you? That's right. It's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, where I speak with the world's best artists about creating works of nonfiction, leaders in the world of narrative journalism, memoir, essay, radio, and documentary film, share their tools and tricks with you so you can improve your own work. Today, I'm happy to introduce you to Erica Westley, at Westley E-R, W-E-S-T-L-Y-E-R, on Twitter. She's a freelance journalist based out of Chicago. She's also the author of Fast Pitch, The Untold History of Softball and the Women Who Made the Game. It's published by Touchstone. We talk a lot about Erica's career moves and pivots, how she worked through the titanic research effort she did on the book, and also how the book was kind of her last-ditch try at writing true stories. But before we get to that, I want to thank the 19 folks who have left 5-star reviews and ratings on iTunes for the podcast. That's incredibly generous and kind. Just last night, in a span of 5 minutes, I left reviews for Tim Ferriss, Chase Jarvis, and Brian Koppelman, three of my favorite interviewers on iTunes. They don't need my help, but if I'm going to ask y'all for reviews, I better be leaving reviews too, you know? So let's keep adding to the total, because the more we get, the more visible the podcast will be, and the more people we can reach, so that we're empowering a community of people eager to do this type of creative work, to tell true stories that connect us, you know? But back to episode 70 with Erica Westley. She grew up in North Carolina, studied dance, but pivoted to sciences and ultimately journalism, something that finally clicked with her. We pick up the conversation where she feels most engaged in the creative process.
Especially now that I do more historical research, I like digging through old newspapers and archives, and just that sense of discovery when you come across a story that you had no idea existed. Certainly when I was doing the softball history research, you know, it's like you're digging a tunnel and you just keep coming across wonderment after wonderment. I really love that process. I think the hard part is finding a stopping point and really piecing it together so that it becomes a logical project. I think if I didn't have deadlines or tangible projects to complete, it would be easy to just kind of keep digging endlessly, and because I do really enjoy that research process.
Yeah, it's a hard line to toe, because you can feel if you just get a little more research, the story would be that much better. And until you realize that the more research you're doing, ultimately what you're doing is kind of just hiding from the next phase of the project. So you're like,
right.
You know, Bronwyn Dickey and Susan Orlean, they talk about when you know the research is done, basically when you see yourself coming the other way. You know, you almost are more of an expert than anyone you've spoken to, because you've spoken to so many people or just gone through so many rabbit holes. So with Fast Pitch, how did you know you were finally done and ready to really start stitching this all together?
Yeah, I mean, I think that holds true. I've heard John McPhee say that too, that when you start talking to people, and doing interviews, and you find that you're not getting any new information. And I mean, that didn't necessarily, I think with such a big project, like the softball history, I still found myself learning, and I did have to kind of cut myself off, at a certain point. But my narrow focus in terms of the main characters I knew I wanted to focus on, and kind of the main decades, which for me was the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, I did reach a point where I felt I had read all of the newspaper articles that I could find, and just, I think there's also just kind of a hard to describe feeling, you know, as a writer, where you just know the story is complete, or it feels complete, and you sort of don't want to mess with that. I think when you have that feeling where you just kind of know that everything is in line, kind of makes a complete narrative.
So how did you find Bertha and Joan Joyce? How did you arrive at Fast Pitch? And what came first? Did you you wanted to write a softball history, or did you stumble across Bertha and then realize that there was this whole can of worms to go right down? So how did you come to it?
I think, you know, I grew up focused on dance, but my father was a huge baseball fan. So baseball was always around in my house, and I didn't grow up with softball at all, but, sort of got into it just watching the college tournament on TV and some of the Olympics coverage as well. And I was just captivated by the windmill pitching, and just the differences from baseball and the subtle differences. But I thought, it was a faster game. And I mean, the bases are closer together, and there's also 7 innings instead of 9. But I think obviously the big draw for me was that women played it, and unlike baseball. And so I thought it was this cool women's sport. And I only knew it as a women's only sport. I hadn't realized until I started working on this book that men had played it, that it had this long history as being a sport for both men and women. But originally, I think I was really captivated by the college tournament. They seemed to have this kind of different, there were all these cheers and this whole dugout culture that exists in college softball. And there's lots of art with the eye black that they wear, when it's sunny out to shield their eyes. So they'll make different shapes, and sometimes the school letters on their faces with the eye black, and different hairstyles that they would wear as a team. And so I was kind of looking actually at doing more of a Friday Night Lights for softball. I think that was my original idea, and I didn't have any more specifics than that. But once I started looking into it more, I found myself digging more into the history, because I really didn't know any of it going in. And that led to the Breakettes, which was the team that Bertha and Joan both played for. And it was, kind of this Connecticut dynasty. I was fortunate in that team still exists. Obviously not exactly in the same way that it did back in the 1950s, but it still exists, and they have a website, and it had some photos, and that was enough kind of a teaser for me to just keep digging in and trying to figure out who these players were and what the stories were that led to this team. And I think that led to me discovering other teams and just sort of just peeling back the layers until I realized that it was kind of the first project that I kind of felt had to be a book. And I had always wanted to write books. And that was kind of always my goal once I started in journalism. And this was sort of the first story I'd come across where it felt like a book to me right away.
It just felt like booky, like this needed, it was just
yeah,
that thing.
Because
yeah.
I had been, most of the other journalists I knew who wrote books, it had come from a magazine feature that they had written. I just hadn't written any magazine articles that felt like they needed to be a book, and I didn't want to force it. And so I was sort of just looking for, I hadn't written about sports much at all at that point. I think just the history was so rich. And I mean, and when I looked, I couldn't find any books about softball history written for a general audience that included all of those stories. And I also wanted to tell the story of softball getting ejected from the Olympics. And so it was, to me, there just wasn't a way to tie that all together in a single article.
It must have been really heart racing in a way, as you were doing research for this and then realizing that nothing of this nature had been done. It must have just been, what was going through your mind when you realized that nothing like this was done? Was it like, like, holy shit, like, I can't believe nothing like this has been done? And did you find yourself having to slow yourself down so you didn't miss any beats and miss any of this research because, like, you realized that you were kind of the spearhead of a book of this nature?
I tried to honor, you know, the stories of the characters, the women that I chose to focus on, but I did it with the idea that this is the first one, and then I think with the hope that it would open it up for other people to maybe write even more focused stories. I did feel that I needed to capture the breadth of the whole softball story and its evolution as a sport. But I think going forward, there could be a lot more specific stories, you know, maybe about just one of those teams or even more focused on just one of the players. You know, I think I did feel sort of obligated in a way to cover everything, because so much of it was unknown. And to me, it kind of hinged, you know, you needed the context to understand the Olympic story and the college softball story as well. And so much of that was unknown. I thought, you know, at least this book kind of can be a foundation maybe. And then going forward, there could be more focus on some of the specific areas, you know, within this huge story.
Yeah, it plays out in a lot of ways, kind of like the sport itself is the main character, if you will. And It's like a real, almost this tragedy. It's this long burn, and then finally it's crowning achievement of making it to the Olympics. You know, it took decades upon decades to get that kind of recognition. And then it just, within 10 years of its inception in the Olympics, it was gone. It was just like, wow, it took so long to get there, got there, and then got stabbed in the back. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's a bummer. But I think a lot of at the heart, you know, and it's true. I did see kind of the evolution of the sport as the main narrative, you know, so that the sport is sort of the main character. And I think if that's, by that logic, then baseball is sort of this other character that's always there. And it's what kind of makes softball perplexing, you know, to this day. And it certainly influenced, it's the main reason that softball got ejected from the Olympics. But I mean, you could also say it's the main reason it was in the Olympics in the first place, because softball got added after baseball was already there. I think it's a hard part of softball. You can't escape its relationship with baseball, and baseball's not going away. It's kind of always there. And I think it's an interesting part of the sport because we don't have cricket or, you know, but I mean, I can't think of another example where you have a very similar sport, you know, existing in the same space. Like, there's not an alternative basketball that exists, and it's hard to find places for both. And I think that's part of the struggle of softball is it's a story of a sport that's in the shadow of another sport that's very similar.
Yeah. When you were writing the book and researching it, like, what surprised you the most throughout the process?
I think there was so much. I mean, it was one of those really, I think, again, with the discovery process kind of keeping you maybe too long in the research stage sometimes. But I think the biggest thing was the company sponsored teams and just realizing how huge the amateur softball scene was and how it really was professional, you know, and what we would call now semi-pro. And just the idea, you know, Bertha Reagan Tickey's kind of the main character, the main player I talk about in the book, because she had an incredibly long athletic career. And just the fact that someone like her in the 1950s would be recruited to play for this company team and flown across the country from California to Connecticut just to play on this company-sponsored softball team, I think that kind of blew my mind. And that there were also these stories of this brewery-sponsored team in New Orleans that kind of did the same thing, recruiting players, women from all around the country starting in the 1930s. to just, you know, to play softball and basically pay them salaries, you know, not akin to the top professional athletes, but pretty close. And also, you know, giving them jobs and relocation expenses. I think that those opportunities existed and that those teams were so competitive and so popular, it did really blow my mind.
When you were writing the book and everything, did you realize, or did it also kind of surprise you? Did you just realize that it was like there were a lot of like overlaps to what's happening today, especially with, say, with college athletics, you know, this quote unquote, like this amateurism that NCAA tries to hide behind. And when mm-hmm. when in fact, it's just, they're practically, you know, pros. And oftentimes they are in some ways getting paid in some manner or form. But did you notice like all these, you know, all these parallels between, you know, 1950s, 60s women's softball to even today in modern collegiate athletics?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you have, you know, and it's true with the Olympics as well, which of course they eventually modified it so that you could be a professional athlete and compete in the Olympics. But for a long time, that wasn't the case. And tennis was that way as well. You know, there was this kind of old British notion that sports should be played by gentlemen amateurs, and the idea of playing for money was crass. You know, and we eventually started having professional sports. You know, and now I think you see that in the U.S. play out certainly with college sports, and it is kind of a unique setup where we've tried to preserve these amateur sports. I personally feel that sports, you know, anything that's inherently competitive, it's hard to contain the professionalism. I think it's a natural byproduct, and trying to contain it, it's a losing battle. And so I think more in favor of what happens in other countries, which is where you would, if you were a star athlete, you would go straight from high school and possibly even younger than high school and have the opportunity to play sports professionally just right off the bat. Because, and I think that's how dance works, especially ballet. That's how it works as well, because you have a short period where you're going to be healthy. Your injury is always an issue. And so, and I think with softball, it's an interesting story, where there were always players who wanted to take it to the professional level. And there was always an active effort by the main organization that oversaw the sport of trying to clamp down on that and kicking out players who had kind of a whiff of playing for money. And but of course, there was always, similar to the college game that you see now, it was always money behind the scenes, where you have these company sponsored teams. So you have players getting paid in the form of perks and, you know, and salaried positions at the company. And so it's not really, it's still professional.
At the time you started the research of the book and you realized that this was something that you wanted to take, you know, straight to the book length, you know, like skip, mm-hmm. you know, you declared for the draft out of high school. You were taking this, you were going pro with this, you know, skipping college, going pro. Where did the confidence come from to attack this as a book without going shorter first? How did you make that approach, and where did you find that, yeah, that confidence to do it and to pull it off, which you ultimately did?
Yeah, I think, just to keep going with the sports analogies, is sort of my Hail Mary. I mean, I was at a point where I was dissatisfied with a lot of the magazine work I had been doing, and I was struggling to do the types of articles I wanted to do. And I felt like doing a book project was sort of my last hope for getting to do the type of writing I wanted to do. I mean, it kind of came from a place of desperation. And I had, through happenstance, met an agent, and I think in just casually talking to her, this was before I'd really had anything together with this softball book, but I think she was the one who really made me realize that I didn't have to have that magazine article and then a book coming from there, that I could maybe carve out my own path and just go straight to a book. I mean, she didn't actually give me that advice or say that. I just sort of, I think I read, you know, read into it what I wanted to or heard what I wanted to hear. But, I think that's where I had the initial confidence was, and then it was sort of just trying it and seeing if I felt like I needed to see it through until, so I did, it took me a long time to find an agent, and there was only one publisher who said yes in the end. But I think I did kind of put the extra effort into trying to make it work because I felt like if it didn't, I was potentially done with journalistic writing, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I think it would have been a big turning point. And so I did sort of really try to work hard on the proposal and putting everything into trying to make that book project work.
So let's unpack that a little bit. So you were heading into the book project, you were pretty, as you said, like dissatisfied with the writing you were doing or the style and or that nature of freelancing, or if you were a staff writer somewhere. What did that dissatisfaction look like? Why were you so, sort of, for lack of a better term, like upset with what you were doing and maybe just forced to do as just a way to make ends meet?
Yeah, I think I had been working primarily as a freelancer for at least 5 years by that point. And a lot of it was just making ends meet, and doing, and even that, I think, the pitch process can be pretty grueling. And a lot of times that's even for articles I didn't necessarily want to write in the first place, but we're just doing to make ends meet. And the idea was that I was supposed to be doing this other thing that was more satisfying on the side, but that wasn't happening or it wasn't working out. And a lot of the magazines, I think it's perhaps inevitable as you grow as a writer, the magazine articles the type of writing you maybe thought you wanted to do or aspired to do becomes less appealing. I started to see that a lot of the magazine features I originally thought, in magazines, not that I want to trash any of these magazines, but to me, they felt formulaic and not, if they were going to be the creative expression I aspired to, then they weren't creative enough, for what I wanted to do. I didn't feel like even in the magazine feature, sphere that I thought I had been working toward that whole time, there wasn't really an example of, at that point, of articles that I really wanted to do, if that makes sense. And so I think that's the frustration was coming from most of the articles I was doing were just, I was making a lot of compromises for some of the features I was getting to do, and just wasn't happy with what I was producing as a writer, and then also not making any money. You're struggling financially. It's supposed to be for this other purpose, that you're doing satisfying work. And then when you realize the work isn't satisfying, then I think that was where I was at that point when I started, instead of waiting to get to do a book, I decided I was just going to try it because I kind of had nothing to lose, I guess, because I wasn't succeeding at magazines either. So, you might as well just go for it.
Yeah. I can kind of attest to that too. Like there were, a few years ago, I was doing a lot of stuff like, slideshow type stuff for like Bleacher Report. I did a lot of that stuff, and I'm like thankful for it. It was like, it wasn't like great money, but it was something I could do from my home press box. I would be doing like winners and losers from the Coca-Cola 600. I did a lot of did a lot of NASCAR. I write mainly about horse racing a lot, so like that's how they first approached me, in 2012 or whatever, to do some Triple Crown stuff. But I'm like, wow, the people I admire doing the writing I admire, not a single one of them was doing a slideshow of winners and losers from day one at Wimbledon. And it's like,
yeah. No, I've done tons of slideshows. I mean, I think, yeah. And the in infographics, I mean, a lot of times the writing takes a backseat and you're not even really writing that many words when you're, you know, and it's,
yeah, it's like
interesting work, but I think after a few years, you know, if writing is your priority, I think you have to find a way to do something else.
Yeah, you realize that the writing a slideshow is its own kind of writing beast, and it wasn't even. I was just writing to a form, and it's not even journalism. You're like piggybacking on other people's journalism, which just annoyed me. Like it was like I had to like use quotes and third party references, and it was like, well, I'm just piggybacking on the work other people are doing. And it just like, I want to be doing the work, you know, I don't want to just be cutting and pasting and then hyperlinking and aggregating. Yeah. Like it just, I'm like, I didn't get into that for that. And it was easy for, you know, it was an easy check with no commute. You know, I was doing it all from home. And in that sense, it was, you know, when you factor wear and tear on a car versus, you know, just being able to stay on your couch, you're like, was easy, but not necessarily satisfying. So I can kind of attest to where you were in that sense.
But. Right. And I think there is, I mean, that is the challenge of going the freelance route, which so many of us are, you know, you kind of have to, but I think in historically the staff writer positions, there's more of a path for where you can grow as a writer, you know, and as a reporter. And when you're freelance, you are kind of in a position of having to figure that out on your own. And it's easy to just to want, keep, you know, ending up in the same place and not necessarily having a path for growth because the publications you're writing for aren't going to establish that for you. And it's even if you are actively trying to do it yourself, it's not that easy or simple to set up.
Yeah. I tried to rationalize it in a sense like, okay, this is a little thing, like so make a little money so you can keep making your art. And, but even then it ends up taking so much of your time away that, just need to kind of, I'd rather have maybe like a day job in retail somewhere,
exactly.
You know, that allows me to like have some steady income. And I'm lucky my wife has the health insurance and everything, so I don't have to worry about that. I'm lucky in that sense. But I might as well just have some sort of day job that doesn't take too much mental RAM and then be able to do the work that, you know, is exciting to me. Like, you know, if I were able to pursue a book of the nature that you just wrote, like, oh, that would be satisfying. And you said it was your last hope. So that was, you know, what was that like knowing it? Maybe you didn't know your next steps after that, but given that it was your Hail Mary, your last hope, you know, what might you have done if it didn't feel as good as it ended up feeling?
You know, I'm not sure. I think there's always that tendency, you know, where I want to go in a complete different direction. You know, writing for me is where it's what I want to do, with my time. So I think it would just be trying to find, you know, I think I would have gone the more literary route, and I possibly would have tried to get into maybe fiction or, you know, just other types of writing. I mean, I think, I don't know if I was completely committed. I'm committed to nonfiction writing now. I think I maybe was more open to other genres then, but I think I would have tried to find a different place for me in the writing world, just experiment until something worked out.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like I've figured too, like, well, if I'm not going to make any money writing nonfiction and sometimes it's not fun and I get burned out, like, but writing fiction's kind of fun. Like, if I'm just not going to make any money in either one, I might as well choose the fun one.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, and I know that poets, for example, like a lot of them do that exact, you know, thing you were talking about where you work at Whole Foods or, you know, a deli, and it's understood that your art isn't going to support you financially. But you find a job that gives you some financial stability, but gives you the time to work on your writing or on what you want to do as an artist. I just hadn't, going into journalism, I sort of mistakenly thought that was the financially stable choice to make, going into writing as a career. And I think, you know, I looked at George Orwell and Hemingway and all of these writers from the past as like, oh, you know, journalism's the stable thing. And it is perhaps compared to poetry, but I think I found myself rethinking that after freelancing for a few years. And
yeah, and what I've found too with the idea, it's too bad that, you know, menial day jobs are like there's kind of like a stigma, especially with people like us who've have a college and advanced degrees, and then it's too bad there is that stigma attached to day jobs, because that actually puts you out in the world with people. And you can overlap with them, and then you can talk to them. And that's how you actually, instead of being insulated in maybe an academic environment where you're just around like a very similar uniform intelligence, you can be out overlapping with all kinds of different people. And those are where the stories are. So it's like, it's too bad that it kind of gets shit on to have a retail job and then doing your writing or even narrative nonfiction on the side, because that's where you're going to find the stories. That's how my first book got published. I was selling shoes and I was sitting across from someone who knew an editor, and she asked me what else I did. I told her I wrote this, you know, I had this book I had written on spec, and a few months later, the book was greenlighted. So it's like, that wouldn't have happened if I was maybe in the academic world. That happened because I was putting running shoes on her feet. So,
right.
You know, so it's, I don't know. I kind of wish that it wasn't as, I don't know, frowned upon or maybe just looked down upon, you know?
Yeah. I think the challenge is a lot of those jobs they can be physically demanding. You know, I think as you get older, it's hard. I mean, I think like for even just me speaking personally, I think I don't feel like I'm quite up for being on my feet all day. Obviously there's plenty of people who are in positions, you know, where they do have to do that. And it's hard on the body, and and that's a whole separate issue. But I do think, I hear what you're saying, and it was a big, rethinking journalism as even being an artistic form of writing, or that it could be. It did kind of make me to see the field in a different way, because I think I went into it maybe with some entitlement, thinking that writing, you know, deserves to earn an income. But I mean, I think when you really think about the type of work, especially if you're talking about doing satisfying writing, that's not just about the, you know, delivering information to the public in the easiest way possible. And by easy, I mean easy to digest, you know, where clarity and just having the information there, the most important information, you know, that the public wants or needs, you know, with that as your basic purpose, if you want as a writer to do that, but in a more artistic way or something that's kind of more personal to you, I think you do have to rethink the financial component and how. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think that does put you more in the category of an artistic writer who, I mean, you could say that society could ascribe a certain value to that type of writing and want to support it as an art. But I think it's also sort of a personal choice, you know, that you're making of it's, especially I think in the U.S., just because of the way things are set up, the burden is kind of on you to try to figure out how to make the money part of it work.
So where are you turning these days for the writing that gets you jacked up and the writing that you want to pursue and keep doing?
I do find myself turning to literary journals more and more. And I wish that there were more that allowed for all different types of nonfiction, because so many of them, you know, tend to be fiction and poetry first, and then the nonfiction is so often personal essays and not kind of more than that. Because I think, you know, and certainly the writing I want to do, I think, is inherently journalistic or journalism influenced, just because that's my background. And I do think I really like books as a vehicle for nonfiction writing, and especially journalism writing. And so I think going forward, I would like to primarily work on books, because I think it's a place where you're not limited to what the publication, what a magazine is doing or focused on. It gives you just, I think, more freedom to write a standalone piece and not have it have to fit in with, the ethos of a certain magazine or newspaper.
Right. So when you're in writer mode, what does your day typically look like? When do you wake up, and what is the nature of your routine? So you start warming up the engine and then you're ready to get going.
Yeah, I have recently had to kind of admit to myself that I do my best work in the morning, but I'm not really a morning person.
Ooh, that's tough.
So there's coffee involved, and I kind of have to just force myself to get working right away, because I don't want to. I think I get those productive hours in the morning, and then I also, I will try to get the writing in the morning, and then maybe shift to research or, doing phone interviews and other types of things in the afternoon. And, I think certainly when you're really intense and having to work, morning, noon, and night on something, it's kind of, I've had to get into the habit more, I think, of, which I think all writers have to do, of forcing yourself to write even when you don't feel inspired or aren't completely sure of what you're trying to say. I think there's just that notion of having to put words on the page and to keep going. And I think I also use Hemingway's advice of always kind of having the idea of what you want to do for the next day, saving a little piece so that you don't have to start from scratch.
Yeah.
And so you kind of know going in, a starting point of what you want to work on. You already have an idea of where you're going, and using that as kind of the starting point and trying to go from there.
Like, given that you like to hit the ground running in the morning, do you have a particular evening or nighttime routine that sets the table so you can just get to your desk and just hit it?
Yeah, I think my general routine is to, again, kind of leave, when I step away from my desk in the evening, to know what I'm going to start with the next day. And I think that kind of gives me permission to turn off my mind for the rest of the night. By kind of figuring out what I'm going to start with the next day, I think gives me a chance to unwind after that, so that I'm not kind of trying to think of things throughout the night.
In the process of editing or writing or even research, what part of that process do you struggle with, or do you find that you are in constant need of sort of improvement? I mean, no one gets 100% mastery, but what do you feel like is a limiter for you that you feel like you have to give more attention to maybe some other facets of the craft?
I think the writing, a lot of it for me is, I struggle, again, I think like a lot of people do, with perfectionism and trying to have things work out immediately and not having the patience to just write, your crappy first draft, and then understand that even if you put a lot of thought into it, it's still probably going to be crappy at first. To just have the patience with the editing process and to kind of be willing to make those mistakes early on, and kind of having faith that it'll improve over time. I think my tendency is to want things to work, or kind of the fear that if it doesn't work out immediately, it isn't going to work out. And I think that's probably my main struggle, is to have the confidence to write something that's not at all good at first, have faith that it will improve and that it can be salvageable.
Yeah. How do you mitigate the feelings of self-hatred early in the draft and then late in the draft?
Yeah, it's hard. I've just kind of learned to live with the self-loathing, I think. And I think the other thing, I mean, one thing that's nice, and I think the reason I stick with nonfiction is that to me, I have these stories to tell that are sort of higher purpose, or, you know, I have this need, you know, or wanting, there's something besides just my voice as a writer that I'm trying to get out there, you know, that there are these people's stories that I want to exist and to, you know, other people to know about and read about. And I think that keeps me going through that self-hatred process.
Yeah. I just finished, I turned in a multi-part feature, a long feature, and just the total and utter just hatred of myself throughout the whole process. Like, I got a little better towards the end, but even when I filed, I'm like, you're the worst who's ever lived. And and it was just like, and to this moment, I'm waiting for feedback from my editor, who's never too happy to edit my stuff anyway, because he's really busy. And I'm just waiting. The more and more days that are passing, I'm picturing the more and more work he's having to do on it. And I'm just waiting and just like dreading his feedback, because it's going to be like, this is more work than I wanted to do. And yeah. It's just going to be a gut punch whenever I get that email back from him. But so
I can relate.
How do you push through the middle of drafts when you're past the honeymoon phase of writing, where, you know, pages 1 through 20 feel awful good, but pages like 110 through 130 are just like, ooh, this is going to take longer than I thought. How do you get through that part?
I think number one, just forcing myself to persevere, you know, even if it feels horrible and I don't want to. But I think rereading, you know, I usually always reread what's already there.
Another Hemingway tactic there.
Right. Yeah. And and try to, yeah, just, you're trying to find that spark. You know, it's something that I think keeps you going, and where you have, maybe it's not a full aha moment, but you know, so you fix it a little bit, something that it feels a little better. And mm-hmm. through that process, I think, you know, you just hope that that's enough to get you forward to the next stage. I mean, and I do struggle, you know, especially with something like a book length project. I always worry, and I have this as a reader, where, you know, a lot of times books can be front loaded. So all the good stuff, you know, it starts off great and it seems amazing. And I think, you know, working on a project like that as a writer, there's the worry that of it dropping off, you know, and it being, having all of your good stuff at the beginning, or, you know, and then it falling apart in the middle. I think that fear, you know, of that, I think, you know, it's maybe inevitable anyway, but trying to minimize that, I think, can give you motivation to work on the middle and the end a little harder.
Yeah, well, John McPhee's new book, he's been harping on structure for forever. And that's his thing. It's like structure, structure, structure. He can't go anywhere until he's drawn a cool diagram. Not that the cool diagram's the end goal, but like, he comes up with the diagram that ultimately propels him through the draft. Have you read his new book yet?
No, I haven't. I read about it, but I haven't, gotten it yet.
It's as good as you would imagine. And it's, it's all about structure. And that very point is, you know, you can't make anything up in this line of work, but you can shape it in such a way so that you can, like Roy Peter Clark says, like, put gold coins along the trail. So like, you're pulling people along. Like, how much are you thinking about structure before you even write your lead or your first chapter?
I think you have to find also what works for you. And I think I kind of came to a point where I realized the McPhee approach doesn't completely work for me. I mean, I think he's amazing, but I think you have to realize, you know, maybe your mind works differently. And I think I always try, as much as I appreciate, you know, the amazing things that he's able to do with structuring a narrative, and innovative, I think sometimes I go back to just trying to do service to the content. And I try to picture myself just telling the story to someone at the bus stop or, you know, whatever. And mm-hmm. I try to go back to kind of that basic storytelling sometimes. And the chronological structure, you know, I think it depends on the story, you know, and what the content is. And you maybe as, you know, kind of like a potter where you're just messing around with the clay and seeing what works best for that specific material. I think sometimes maybe you have to just admit that, you know, a straight chronological narrative is what works best, or sometimes, you know, something, I think you have to kind of sometimes do the thing where you're seeing where the material pulls you and then trying to make it work from there. Every person, I think, you know, some people go the McPhee model and it totally clicks for them, you know, and they're really into that. And I think, but I also think there's hope for people, you know, like me, who, where it doesn't work as well. And you try to find something else.
Yeah. I'm kind of like, not that I've ever articulated it like this before, but I'm kind of like just an energy guy. Like when I plot things out, like I feel where I get more excited. And as long as I have like those peaks, like if I'm able to graph it as like, all right, this feels like there should be a peak here. And like, it just kind of just plods along like that. I'm also a big, you know, like the writers of Breaking Bad, how they break out stories on cork boards. Like, have you seen how they do that? Well, Vince Gilligan in history, he took it from the showrunner of X-Files, whose name I'm blanking. But when Gilligan, you know, started Breaking Bad, when they break stories, here you go, like this, you know, this genius show. And, you know, I don't know if it's your thing, but I loved it. But they've got 8 really brilliant writers in a room for a month on end, you know, doing story beats together, 8 hours, 10 hours a day, thinking of these things. And then when they have that a good little scene, they put on an index card and tack it on the board in a 4-act structure, a teaser in 4 acts. Which are just, you know, threaded around ads, right, of course. But it was just like, that structure really appealed to me. Is just like when you're putting those those index cards up there, those are the coins those are narrative blocks. And so that really, it helps visualize. And, but also it's an energy thing too, you know, and it's pulling people along. So that appeals to me. And you can see it in a flash. You've got your cork board on the wall. You're like, all right, there we go. That's how we're progressing here. And so along those lines, you know, something with like fast pitch and everything, which had so much research, how did you organize all that research so you didn't get bogged down in all the material you had, and then you were able to easily access it to write the book?
It was a somewhat disjointed process, but I did know, you know, that I was, I think also because I was researching and writing at the same time. And so even just, you know, I had a lot of bookmarks, I had a lot of digital files. But I do still, you know, struggle with when you're doing that research of how to label it, because you think it's going with one group of things, but you don't necessarily know, you know, and as the project takes shape, it might actually, I think at first I was grouping things by topic, but when you have, I think eventually it turned into more of a chapter, you know, outline. I don't have a perfect system by any means. And I think another challenge is that working on article length pieces, I often relied on my memory, and it's one of my strengths with research is that my memory is pretty strong. So I often wouldn't, you know, I would know where things were, but when you start dealing with a much larger project, memory isn't going to cut it. And even if, you know, I would often fall into a trap where I thought I remembered where something was and I was totally wrong. And I spent, you know, an hour looking for it, and it's horrible when you're pressed for time to be in that situation. And so I think it's something I'm still always trying to figure out. And I do have a new, I started using this service called Digo.
Digo.
It's D-I-I-G-O. And I think they have different, you know, there's a free version. And I think I do the version where you pay a fee each year. It's a really awesome bookmarking service that it works for me because it's just a place where, especially when you have all different types of material, of sometimes links, you know, to a website and sometimes a PDF and or photos, and it's just a great place. And you can tag it and then search for those words a really simple way. So the label isn't as important, the label I come up with, because I can search for, you know, if I had a thing where Humphrey Bogart was mentioned, you know, I can just look for Humphrey Bogart and it'll pull up the article, because I'll vaguely remember there's something about Humphrey Bogart that I wanted to reference that I'd found in some newspaper clipping from months before, and that I've found helpful. But it is tricky, and I think it's something where I think, you know, in this nonfiction work where you're wearing different hats, and so sometimes you're wearing the journalist hat, but sometimes you find yourself wearing the historian hat, and that can be kind of unfamiliar because you don't necessarily have the training for that, or the librarian hat, you know. And I do think also just trying to get professional help from either academics or librarians, you know, and getting advice on how to keep that stuff sorted, and also just how to do the research in the first place.
Mm-hmm. How do you define your own rigor and tenacity and hard work in this line of work? You know, given that you have an athletic background with dance and everything, and I consider dance some of the most just gruelingly athletic art forms that there are, and having come from an athletic background myself, it's like I know what 1,000 swings on my tee in the basement feels like, and I know that that's hard work that you do every day to become a good hitter. How do you define it with your writing? You know, what is your metric for a day of hard work, or a month, and then a year, so forth?
I do appreciate, especially I don't feel like I'm the most disciplined writer, and I'm often lazy, and a lot of it is just forcing myself to work. And sometimes maybe you aren't as productive, you know, and you don't have as full a day as others. But I think for me, it's just the consistency of persevering and keep working on it on a daily basis. And I mean, honestly, I do have to worry sometimes about burning out. And I think you don't want to push too hard, because then you need to, it's a, you know, it's a marathon. So you need to find that balance where you still have the energy and interest and ability to keep going day after day.
Yeah. It's, I was talking to Peter Brown Hoffmeister about this a couple weeks ago. He was episode 68, and he does, you know, his thing is pretty much at least 500 words a day. You know, some days it's going to be maybe 3,000, but he tries to at least do 500. And I think you can almost view it as like, yeah, to put it in physical terms again, like how do you train without getting too sore? You know, you don't want too much. If you have a lot of muscle soreness, you want to maybe go a little easy the next day. So it's kind of like, how do you ride those energy levels? You know, if you have the material to draw on, you've done your research, so you have the raw material. It's like, well, should today be a 500 word day, or should I really just hammer 6,000 and just go for it? So it's like, I wonder, do you tend to have those kinds of peaks and valleys, or do you try to keep it, you know, say like 500 a day for every day, or just, you know what, today I'm feeling hella good, so I'm just going for 10,000 or something?
Yeah, I think it depends. I mean, sometimes I think I tend to, I think setting a word count, you know, like 500 words, I think that sounds good. And I have done that in the past. And I think I also sometimes am just focused on kind of a more general deadline. And I try to be realistic, but also kind of push myself, you know, and saying like, I need this done by the end of the month. And just kind of knowing that, you know, some days I'm going to push harder. And then, but I think it's sort of that long-term goal in a way, structures the days of, kind of just knowing you need a certain amount done by the end of the end of the month, or, you know, just sometimes even if it's just an arbitrary deadline. I think, you know, and maybe it's coming from the journalism background where I got used to writing on deadline. But I think that helps me kind of budget my time each day.
What are some book or books that you find yourself rereading time and again, influential books that are kind of like a North Star for you?
Yeah. Well, we've already talked about Hemingway a bit, but I think A Movable Feast is one of those books. I mean, it's pleasurable to read, and I think it's one where I don't know, even though I've reread it multiple times, it's one where I'm still always discovering little tidbits, and, you know, I don't know it by heart yet. So it's still something that I enjoy rereading each time.
It's so good. I love that. Oh, it's such a good book.
Yeah, it's kind of got, I mean, if you like food, it's got food and travel, yeah, but also, you know, a lot about just writing and Paris, which I've never even been to Paris, so it's, it's just fun to kind of transport yourself into that world. I think, you know, from a more practical standpoint in terms of the type of writing I aspire to do, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth from Other Suns, or of Other Suns.
Yep.
Either way, it's just a wonderful, you know, example of a history book that is told through characters, covers multiple decades, and it's again, structurally, she's moving back and forth through time, and that was something, it's something that I always kind of find myself wanting to do with history, because I found myself doing with the softball book as, or knew that I wanted to do with the softball book as well, to talk about the present day and historical work, and then also have these, you know, compelling narratives going on all the while. And then another, and I also read a lot of fiction still, and I think the author's name is Jenny Offill, but the book's kind of a novella called The Department of Speculation, and it's only, you know, it's only about 100 pages, but it's just this really well-told story. It's kind of atmospheric, and it's got all the stuff about Carl Sagan in it, and because she's also the character, she's a writer, she also, you know, teaches, I think, in like an MFA program, and but to make money, she's ghostwriting this rich guy's book about the history of space exploration, or, you know, it's kind of this like ridiculous project, and the guy is, you know, it's a really beautiful book, and it's one of those books that's densely packed, but short and really easy to just read over and over again. And I think just for general inspiration, a book like that helps me a lot of trying to push myself and not just do kind of the complacent formulaic thing, you know, with writing, even explanatory writing. I think there's room for artistry in there, even if you're just trying to make something clear and, just deliver information to someone.
Mm-hmm. What other artistic media do you like to consume aside from books or magazine articles to help inform your writing?
I love music. I love going to art exhibits. I think my tastes skew toward modern, so I really love modern art. I really love jazz, but I kind of listen to all varieties of music. And I mean, I love watching movies and TV too. I mean, I think what you were saying about Breaking Bad, it makes a lot of sense to use, even if sometimes film and TV storytelling can be formulaic. There are a lot of examples where you know, where it's not, and you can really draw inspiration from that and kind of how you keep the audience engaged. And especially if you're talking about a long running story that is occurring over, you know, several seasons of a TV show.
That idea, like Hattie Fletcher, who's the managing editor of Creative Nonfiction magazine, she says, like, just because something is structured or outlined doesn't necessarily make it any less artful. Like, sometimes making those, like, having outlined or plotting things out, actually putting those constraints on you can actually free you up creatively. I don't know if you've experienced that, like maybe having a certain, well, that's kind of like facts. You know, facts are what they are, nonfiction. So, like, those are the constraints. Right. But within those constraints is where you can actually find some creativity.
Right, definitely. And I think I'm a big fan of outlining and kind of getting more detailed as you go. But I think the outline itself can often kind of show you the path that that makes sense for your story structurally. So I think a lot of times it makes sense to just plot it out, and you can often discover little nuances that you hadn't thought about before doing that.
And with respect to, like, freelancing and this kind of long form journalism, what do you know now that you wish you knew maybe 5 or 10 years ago that could have, like, maybe set you up a little bit better to absorb some of the blows and punches that come your way?
I think I wished that I would wish that I knew more, I think, about the literary magazines, because I wasn't really even looking at that originally. And then I had no idea kind of how to make that work, you know, with my background. And I think if I had maybe started reading those types of publications early on, I would have seen, you know, would have kind of helped me work in, you know, or see the types of creative nonfiction writing that existed. Because I think even now, you know, the way that the fields are taught are very separate. And there's this idea that journalism is one thing and creative nonfiction is this other thing. And I think it's too bad that there's not more overlap, because I think there's a lot of people who, you can benefit from both. And I think I didn't necessarily realize all the options that were there at first, and was sort of committed to this more traditional journalism path because of that.
How have you dealt with feelings of jealousy or competition among peers? And I know, like, me personally, I know it's hard to keep my eyes on my own train tracks. You know,
yeah.
There is a tendency to look and say, like, oh man, how, you know, why are they there when they're 10 years younger than I am? What did I do wrong? Like, have you ever run into that? Those
sure.
kind of feelings?
Yeah. And I think especially when I lived in New York, it can really be, a powerful force in a negative way. And I think there's just recognizing that it's, there's no benefit from it. I mean, to me, I mean, maybe for some people, I'm not really that competitive by nature. And so for me, it's just a negative distraction that I need to try to focus on myself. And I think leaving New York, you know, for me did help with that as well, because it wasn't suffocating in the way that it can be in New York, where it just feels like you're surrounded by it and all the people are there, and going to, you know, special book launch things that you're not invited to or know about. And it can feel really cliquish. And I think for me, getting out of the city, and I went from New York to Tucson, Arizona, and so it was vastly different atmosphere wise. And I think that helped me to kind of center and focus on myself and not get, because it can really be toxic to get pulled into that. And it ultimately, you know, you don't want to waste time with that, because it's already hard enough as it is to get the work going.
Oh, yeah. It is poison. Is that where you start, well, like, geographically, is that where you started the research for Fast Pitch when you were in Arizona?
No, but I started in New York, but Arizona was where I really you know, started my relationship with the publisher and had the, you know, the tangible book project. So that's where I was really able to just be working on the book full time.
What still excites you, and what's next for you as you've, you know, put this project to bed, of course, and now you're moving forward. So what's getting you up in the morning right now?
I'm working on a project that's about the history of swimming instruction and drowning prevention, and I'm hoping that will be my next book project. So I had a fellowship that I was able to do at the University of Michigan last year, and that gave me the opportunity to kind of do a lot of the research and sort of have an idea of you know what the project might look like, and exploring different avenues that I maybe wouldn't have allowed myself to explore if I was on a tight deadline. So that was a really unique and wonderful opportunity for me to just kind of go, you know, and explore in a really abstract way. And now I'm sort of trying to fine tune it and hopefully, you know, get the next book project out of it.
Fantastic. Do you have a publisher or an agent lined up for it yet? Or are you still like fine tuning that?
Yeah, I think I'm working kind of on the outline now and trying to still just have, yeah, fine tuning like exactly what I kind of want to do with it.
Yeah.
Before, because I think, as you know, I mean, I think it's hard to sell people on a vague idea when you don't know quite what it is, you know, then I think that makes people nervous.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll see. I think I do definitely hope to stay with books going forward. I just think that's the best fit for me and for what I want to do as a writer.
Okay, that's a wrap. Put a bow around episode 70. Thank you to Erica Wesley at WesleyER on Twitter. Share this episode with a fellow CNFer and leave a nice review if you're feeling froggy on iTunes. Did you know that I also have a monthly newsletter at brendanomero.com? Well, I do. Join the growing list of people who get my monthly reading recommendations, as well as what you might have missed in the world of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. 4 books, once a month, no spam ever. Dig it? Good. So, say hi on Twitter. I'm at Brendan O'Mara. So, until next time, thanks for listening.